Welcome back to Asian Provocation, and you're with me, Ayota Tarexia. On this episode, I speak to Ian Robertson, a photographer, filmmaker, musician, and writer. This recording was made in his apartment just before he moved to Miami Beach, Florida. As a bonus, this podcast is also available in video format on YouTube, where you can see slides of Ian and his family. You can find a link to the Asian Provocation YouTube channel in the description. Do you meditate?
Yes. Meditation is a good practice for me. Always has been. My mother was very esoteric in her ways. We grew up Christian, which I left from as I became older, but still, her ways were always very mystical. She would often talk about mindfulness, how meditation is needed, and how it's needed to encourage every single part of your craft. It was important to her, and it became important to me.
What was your relationship with Christianity as a child?
I think more based on hope instead of faith, hoping that something bad wasn't going to happen, or hoping that I would make it to some sort of afterlife that I thought I deserved, which allowed me to separate myself fairly easily from it. I became easily dissociated with the faith of being a Christian. Spiritually, I couldn't align myself with it as I became a man, and I felt like I began to neglect certain accesses of my consciousness because of it.
Can you give an example of that loss of connection?
Feeling like I'm at a crossroads with how I should progress in life. One side is telling me to go with God, go with the unseen. The other was telling me to move how you want to move. Move at your own accord. Love how you want to love. Have faith how you choose to have faith. Not from doctrine, but from within.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. I lived there for 18 years. Myself, my mother, my twin brother. It's very interesting living in a place that is equally dangerous as well as it is fruitful. And it lost its touch through corruption and evil and greed. But this is a place that I saw as my home, as my habitat, a safety net, somewhere where I felt safe and at the same time, not safe.
Did you experience violence as a child?
I grew up knowing about violence around me, not seeing too much violence. I saw a lot of the aftermath of violence. And exposing myself to that early desensitized my mind to violence. It became a part of my environment.
What was your first memory of racism?
I remember when I was in sixth grade, and I remember being with my brother in the suburbs for the first time. We had no idea what it was like, but we were excited because it was new, and it was something we had never seen or had access to. My first experience with racism knew that I was different. It made me feel different right away. And it wasn't blatant racism. It was more implied. Having dinner at a friend's house and the parents asking me what I do in my house, which some would say is a normal thing. However, the implications through the questioning made me feel different, made me feel like I didn't belong, made me feel like I was an outsider. And I remember that feeling to this day. And it's a feeling that comes up every time I experience some sort of implied racism through maybe a microaggression or feeling uncomfortable in an environment where people don't look like me, where I can feel those eyes on me, hearing the whispers, the pointing fingers, all of it brings me right back to that dinner table in Taylor, Michigan, being asked what it's like living with no father. How many times have I moved around? And can I afford to stay next year?
Tell me about this friend of yours.
He was a neighbor who, in my apartment complex at the time, lived directly behind me, him and his brother and their mom. And I always felt that somehow my quality of life was better than his through how my mother treated us and cared for us and nurtured for us and built an environment for us. So when I would go to this friend's house, he would feel completely different. For lack of a better term, literally black and white, or night and day. I came from a clean, tidy house, and this person had a very abrupt, aloof living situation. Cigarette butts in the ashtray on the coffee table, pornographic magazines underneath the bed in the boys' room, things that they had access to that we would never have access to. And I remember this person calling me a nigger. And to his defense, was a playful act. However, growing up black and growing up black in America, it is most definitely the wrong button to push. In that moment, I didn't know how to feel. What was I supposed to do? Attack my friend? Sit there and take it? You want a friend. You're living in this environment where not a lot of people look like you. And this person lives directly behind you, so there's no escaping them. So my plan was to shake it off, let it go. I remember telling him to shut up, and we kind of chuckled, although I felt incredibly uncomfortable. However, I was willing to thrive on the idea that I had a friend, someone who shared the same likes as me, who skateboarded like me, and we went to the same school. It was something that I'll never let go of, although I do forgive this person, simply because we did not understand ourselves back then.
What kind of things did you enjoy doing together?
Mostly skateboarding, sometimes smoking cigarettes or riding bikes. We always hung out in the neighborhood or spray painted the side of some building. We were just trying to figure things out. What interests us in our environment around us? The difference between living in the inner city Detroit and living in a suburb is the access and the freedom. We went everywhere in town because we felt incredibly safe. And not only did we feel safe, but my mother felt safe about us playing around in this town, in this environment. She felt confident that nothing would happen to us. So we would go to the mall, go to Hot Topic, go to Vans, Journeys, look at shoes, walk around with our skateboards, sometimes skate in the mall, and most definitely get kicked out by mall security on a regular basis. I felt like I was feeling how I was supposed to feel as a 12-year-old kid welcoming his adolescence.
Were you aware of your blackness at that point?
I was aware of my blackness from family. I saw my blackness, but I didn't know what it was just yet. I knew that I was black. I knew that I was African American. But the responsibility of having this black skin, being in this black body, I did not know yet. I did not know my body yet. But I was reminded of my blackness often from seeing the characters and spirits of my family members and how they would act when we would be together in functions, having Sunday dinner after church. That's when I was aware of my blackness. This was something that I always knew, that I always saw, aside from myself in the mirror every day. These things, these environments, these actions, these commitments to love through culture, they were apparent. That's how I knew my blackness. It wasn't until I got older that I really started to understand what it felt like to be black, especially what it felt like to be a black man. Which I would say was the turn of the century. Coming online to my blackness and coming online to the fact that I'm a black man in this body, I felt excited, yet at first point I felt a bit discouraged because I still felt different, although wanting to feel like everybody else.
How did you feel different around your friend?
In that moment, my friend made me feel different, or more like, don't forget you are this, which made me feel incredibly different. But it was a sense of denial because I couldn't understand truly the difference between being someone's friend or being someone's black friend. And I felt like I was this person's black friend, not their friend. I started to feel like I was a token. That's where I felt different. Our friendship didn't last for maybe from middle school to maybe the first year in high school. And we kind of separated. My brother and I, we moved. We started having different friends. other friends that were encouraging us to do different things. And we were interested in different things. In eighth grade, I gained the friendship of my best friend to this day, James Willis. He's amazing. Always been amazing. And he's Black. And that's where I really started to feel like I had something in common with someone. This person looked like me, sounded like me. We have the same skin tone, and we were interested in a lot of the same things. He was the introduction to my Blackness as a Black man, as a Black boy.
When did you move to New York City?
I moved to New York City in 2014.
Did you move to New York City with your best friend, James?
No. James was living in California. We both had enlisted into the military at 18. I went into the Army. James went into the Marines. We went at the same time, trained in the same state, deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan at different times. But once he got out of the Marines, he stayed in California for a bit, where I went to school in California for 3 years. And then 2014, I moved on to New York City.
What led you to joining the Army?
To this day, I feel like it was a mixed bag. I feel like there were so many things contributing to me enlisting. I had a fascination with being a soldier, what that felt like, what it was like to have a sense of control as a sense of authority. I was very curious of what that would feel like. In high school, I was in ROTC, which is essentially just drill and ceremonies and military history. There's no combat or tactics being taught. But you are encouraged, if you do well, you are encouraged to join the military, whatever branch it may be. That is a place that will help you direct yourself towards a military career instead of just walking off the street and then going into a recruitment office and asking for a contract. So I felt like I had a sense of guide, like a manual, and I picked my journey from there, from 18.
What did you feel when you joined the Army?
I felt a lot of joy at first. I felt joy when I raised my right hand because I thought I was doing something that I truly believed in. Although, after a few years, I knew that I actually didn't believe that. I believed more of myself. It went from exciting to administrative and meditative. How do I push through this? How do I survive through this? As I choose my destiny to go further within my military career, how do I stay alive? How do I gain intelligence? How do I gain mental toughness?
You were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. What did you feel when you were there?
When I was in Iraq, I felt powerful. I was young. I had just pinned sergeant at 20 years old, which is really young to become a sergeant. So I felt encouraged. I felt unbeatable, which is weird to say as I watched death and destruction happen all around me. But Afghanistan, I was afraid. I was afraid mostly because of the environment. Something about the environment didn't make me feel the power that I felt in Iraq. I felt that I needed to be more aggressive, more dangerous, which the memories from trips to Afghanistan are forever soaked into my consciousness, saturated in nature.
How many years did you serve in the military?
I did 5.5 years active service, and about a year and a half with a reserve unit during my first year of college. Although it was my first year of college and I had left active duty service, I still felt like I was on active duty. The consciousness of being a soldier hadn't left my body and hadn't left my spirit. And I was doing this in the midst of reclaiming my place in society.
Do you see yourself as an integral member of the system?
I believed for a while that I was an integral member of society, of this system. However, I was made very aware very quickly that I was not. And it was a struggle. One argument is you don't belong because you decided to go to war. You volunteered. The other side is acute racism. Don't forget, you are still Black. You are still African American in this country. Regardless of what you have done, it doesn't matter. you are still in this body. So I was torn, and I struggled very early. And I denied it, and I hid it from people, but I was struggling.
In which ways were you reminded of that when you returned and reacclimated to civilian society?
It was from how people looked at me. I was reminded of those same eyes that looked at me before as a kid. It brought me right back there. It made me feel that what I've done doesn't matter. So in spite of that, it made me be more aggressive, more angry, to have more discontent with people than I did even when I was in the military, because I felt like an outcast.
What kind of minor feelings did you experience in New York?
I remember when I first started growing my locks, my hair really long. And in the beginning stages, it gets really frizzy and it's hard to maintain because your hair is trying to lock and it doesn't want to listen. So I was very self-conscious of that, although I wanted my hair to be a part of my identity, to be a part of my blackness. So one day, I was on an editorial. This particular magazine editor was very curious about my hair. It started with stares, the uncomfortable stares, the look of a misunderstood perception of someone else's identity. She approached me, looking me up and down, not saying anything. I smiled gently, simply because I want to make myself appear to be welcoming, not hard or brash. So she approached me, and after her looks, she began with a smirk, and she asked, "How do you get your hair like that?" Before I could answer, she asked another question. "Is it dirty?" "It must be. I only know dreadlocks to be of dirty hair, so you must not wash it, do you?" I replied, "As a matter of fact, I do wash it. I have to keep my hair and my scalp incredibly clean in order for my hair to grow very healthy. This process is a lot of work. Although neglecting my hair, it will turn into this, and a style that is more healthy for me. It takes a lot of work." She then replied, "So your hair isn't dirty?" And I said, "Correct. My hair is not dirty. It is actually, in fact, clean." And she said again, "Well, it looks dirty." From that moment, it allowed me to realize that no one that looks like me or feels like me in this industry, in New York City, as a matter of fact, they don't see themselves. They don't see how they look at us, how they look at me. They see something that was given to them that's a lie, that's false, and they've believed it for so long that they are in denial of my perspective as a black person, as a black man. I saw this for my entire time here in New York City, working. Every day that I went to a job, I encountered something like this from a white person.
What attracted you to fashion and the work of image production?
The attraction simply was design, color, emotion, feeling, the vibrations of color and sound together. It moved me to want to create, and I knew that I was capable. So I had a dream, like most people do, especially coming here. That first dream, or the first part of that dream, was to work in fashion as a fashion photographer. However, when I was creating images, creating portraits, I felt that I needed more movement, that the characters of people that I was willing to capture needed more motion. And the images that I was taking at the time, the still images, they reflected cinematography. So I had a decision to make whether I was going to try and be this fashion photographer in a place that doesn't want me to be a fashion photographer, or do I become a filmmaker, which is all hands on deck. So I decided to do it because I knew that I could do it, that I was capable, and I wanted to broaden my perspective. I wanted to broaden my aesthetic, and it put me in other places, allow me to wear other hats as a filmmaker. I was working with sound or working as a grip or a dolly grip. That interest put me in more places than photography.
Did you find yourself facing that childhood friend pattern again in adulthood?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I feel every year I've encountered this type of person or persons. I've always felt like it's a non-stop cycle of meeting this character over and over. And every time I go right back, I don't always stay long back in that feeling, in that emotional memory. Sometimes I come back within a second. Sometimes the image is just put in front of me and then it goes away. But I'm reminded of who this person is.
Was this something that reoccurred recently?
Yeah. And this person I've been friends with for a long time. The first thing that ended up taking place, though, took place my first year in New York, which we were both able to identify, which I was glad he was able to identify as a white person. And sometimes we talk about it. We kind of laugh about it. In its nature, it is silly. It is idiotic. And it is also incredibly racist.
What is?
This person that I worked for offered me a job to work on an ad with them. And I had done, as an intern, plenty of unpaid shoots with this person. And I introduced my best friend to this person, to this photographer. And afterwards, she offered me this job that I could not take because I had another obligation. And usually, I took a low rate from her. I shouldn't have, but I did, because I wanted to work and I wanted exposure, like all of us do. So I asked the studio manager, what's the rate? Well, first I asked the photographer, I said, hey, what's the rate for it? She told me a number. And I was like, okay, you know, the usual low number that I get. I said, I cannot do it, but I have someone in mind who just got to New York City, who really needs work and would actually enjoy this. So I gave it to my best friend. But something didn't feel right when I asked about my rate the first time. She was very dodgy, very weird, which she didn't have to be. She was always giving me a low rate. So once I told her that my friend accepted, I needed to know the rate again. But I didn't want to ask her this time because of how she made me feel. So I went to her studio manager and I asked her. I said, hey, my friend is going to take the job and she doesn't know what the rate is. I lied. I said, she doesn't know what the rate is yet. Could you let me know what the rate is so I can tell my friend? She then told me that he would be offered double the rate, so the full rate. When she told me, I paused and I said, okay, I'll let him know right away. But immediately, I felt heartbroken and I felt stripped of my power. I felt stripped of my creativity. And I then became confused on my self-worth because I didn't understand. Why would this person who I've been loyal to cut me out of something that I'm actually owed if I were to take the job? Why would she do that? Why would she make me feel like that? It puzzled me.
Yes.
I cried on the train because of how confused and how emotionally upset I was. However, my friend took the job. He got the full rate. He even had dinner at her house. Something that I would never be allowed to do. So it hurt very badly.
Why do you think your friend was treated differently?
I do want to say because he was white, but I feel like that's the base layer. I feel like the base layer of the issue is him being white and her being white. I feel like there's a sense of trust. Racism allows people to act with a sense of trust with a person that they feel or that they're not racially motivated against. I think that was the base layer. But I think on top of that, actually, you know what? I don't know what's on top of that. I didn't feel anything else. I can't to this day think of anything else. Why she would pick him to give the full rate to instead of me, someone who had been loyal to her for months. Although these things happen in our industry, people will cut you off very quickly. I couldn't help but feel that it was because of who I was to her.
How does working in film and photography in New York compare with being a soldier at war in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I think it was comparable in ways that affected my mental space. When I was in the military, a lapse of judgment meant that I'm completely lost. I'm being outside of myself, outside of formation, outside of the mechanics of what I should be doing. That's what a lapse of judgment meant. But here, having a lapse of judgment felt incredibly easy to conjure, mostly because of how you're affected emotionally. You're affected emotionally in so many ways, and the biggest things are negative ways that are affecting you emotionally. Your self-image, your image as an artist, what you're creating, how you create, where you come from, who you look like, how much money you have, your ethnicity, it all matters. In the military, none of that shit matters. But here, it matters. The mental toughness that I had applied throughout my life, it found its crossroads here. My mental toughness was tested in more ways than one, greater than my experiences in the military, mostly due to racism, implied racism, not necessarily explicit. That explicit racism I often found through imagery or how the image is made, but the implied racism existed through communication and relationships, business relationships, either on set or even in an email. The idea of having to adapt to something because it is the standard of where you work, and that standard is very Eurocentric and filled with white supremacy. So being a person of color, your mental toughness can become flawed, or you can find your flaws within your mental toughness because you're in a place that doesn't want you here. It uses you, and it uses your image, it uses your body, but it doesn't want you. It doesn't want to celebrate you if you're a person of color. It just wants to take from you. In this industry, like I said earlier, it takes. It doesn't give, it takes. I'm only imagining how hard it could be for a woman of color. I have friends who have experienced greater things than I have that are very heartbreaking. Although I felt like the things that happened to me were heartbreaking, the women that I know that are working in this industry, and a lot of them very successful, have been tried to the utmost. So it makes me question a lot of things about being here, working here, creating here, feeling here, loving here, because I feel like those things have been taken away from me.
Did you ever speak again with that employer and friend you recommended for the job?
I never had a further conversation with the woman I was hiring. See, she eventually burned a lot of bridges within her career, although she's still working, and I stopped working for her. The conversation that I had with my friend, he tried to understand and be empathetic to the idea, to my emotions and how I felt, although I was never sure if he was truly online, mostly because he's a white person, so he's not living in the body of someone who already, as a foundation, doesn't belong. However, he felt empathy, and since then, he has worked hard to educate himself on why these things happen as they happen. So we do get reminded of that moment. I think the last time we talked about that, or we were reminded of that through conversation, was maybe about a couple years ago. And again, we laughed and we thought how stupid it was, but we never forgot how painful it was. We never forgot how bad I felt and how heartbroken I was. We'll never forget that.
What is your relationship to the concept of nationhood, these United States of America?
As a former soldier, as an African American, as a man, as a black man, I feel like the concept of this country is so flawed. I feel like it conceptualizes overcompensation. Visually, you can see that in this country. You can see massive amounts of overcompensating in many arenas in this country. Where it overcompensates, especially, is capitalism and white supremacy. This is the only country on the planet that will not recognize its roots, where its society comes from. A massive percentage of this country still refuses to recognize what has happened just 400 years ago. Refuses and argues. It's like watching a child become a narcissist. You know it's happening. You see it right in front of you. And although you challenge it, there's nothing you can really do about it but discipline the person. And if you discipline too abruptly, you begin to abuse the person. So what do? How do you educate a narcissist? How do you make a narcissist feel, especially if they're immature? This country as a whole is the property of narcissism, as well as racism and murder. But narcissism is the biggest fruit we have here in this country, which has allowed the overcompensation of everything we touch here, which has sickened the soil that we live on, which in turn has sickened its people.
Where do you stand today? Where do you find yourself within the system?
I find myself not caring. I find myself feeling safe, yet emotionally feeling vigilant. Physical vigilance, I do not feel. I have felt it, but it is moving away from my body. What is residual is my emotional vigilance, trying to survive within my mind because of what's around me. Everything that has touched me, that I've consumed, that I've come into contact with, every person that I've made a relationship with here is putting me in a place of emotional vigilance. So I feel by myself. Although I'm not alone, and I have people who love me dearly, I cannot help but feel alone. I cannot help but look out into this sea of people, me feeling by myself, floating, treading water. Before, it started to feel like a panic because I wasn't used to this feeling. However, through mental toughness, I know that I have to accept this feeling. And now, this feeling has encouraged me to want to leave this place, leave New York City, that is. A change of environment, a change in pace, and a change for my spirit and my body and my mind, so that they may be again become cybernetic, work in a continuous function with one another. Because before, they became split into three, cast into different parts and regions within myself, within my being. But this feeling of being alone has allowed me to bring these things back together.
What are those three parts?
My mind, my body, and my spirit.
Where's your twin brother today?
My twin brother today is in Southeast Asia, in Laos, working for a tech company, living in paradise, as he says, and building his worth and reaching for a greater sense of himself. It's motivating, it truly is.
Do you feel connected to him?
Yes, although sometimes being a twin, at least in my perspective, I find myself wanting to be separate because we've been together. Well, we were together the first half of our lives. And when we became men, we started to live separate lives. But now we're coming back together and trying to find a familiar space with one another.
What does it mean for you to be a man?
To be a man, I feel, is an essence of your character. I feel to be a man is to love and to feel and to weep and to play and to encourage. I feel that as a man, I'm here to gain reconnaissance on how I want to live, how I want to commit acts of love, how I want to choose to give to people, to give to myself. However, I think that's only a nomenclature for being in this body. If there was no such thing of a word man, I wouldn't even know to use it. But because I've been given this label, I try to find ways to identify what that is, even through physicality. The thing is, I can never actually come up with a real answer, because the answers that I display and just displayed aren't just about being human, not man. I've always felt human. Playing certain societal roles would make me feel up to that so-called nomenclature of being a man, being asked to do certain things, whether it's in my work life, my love life, or how society sees me. But I've always just thought human, because trying to acclaim to this label of being a man is quite confusing. If you ask most men what it is to be a man, they often conceit more about their sexuality, which is wound up within misogyny, a lot of homophobia, transphobia, and a lot of self-hate. A lot of self-hate. Mostly because the idea of man is given this image of a harsh type figure, strong, but like a stone that cannot be moved. Which isn't true. Stones can be moved, and so can man. But this idea that man is superior through his sexuality and his physical self has set confusion amongst all men on how we should feel because of how we were assigned from birth. When, in my opinion, frankly, you should feel however the fuck you want to feel, and the rest comes after. Your mental toughness will allow you to navigate your feelings, whether you're man or woman. But this idea of man is poisonous to me, because to live as any human being, you should be encouraged to live as a human being.
What is your relationship with power and authority?
You know, power and authority are things that I would seek as a young adult man, because I thought that's what I needed to do as a young adult man, was to seek power and authority, to be superior, to be a proctor of something or over someone. But as I grew into an older human, a more mature, relaxed, chill human, I saw that this identity of man is incredibly flawed, and it is filled with a sense of authority. This is where I first started identifying my self-hate, through wanting power and authority. I hated having authority over me. However, I wanted to inflict, and I'm using that word purposely, inflict power and authority, because I had hated it so much, and it didn't feel like it was assigned to me. So I became toxic in my ways. I used masculinity to approach situations, to incite fear and superiority. It challenged my mental scope because I was ready to move away from those things as I became older. But those things had become ingrained and so prevalent within my body and within my mind that it was hard to move away from. I had to literally wipe the slate clean with myself, dissociate myself from myself. And that sounds crazy and fucked up, but I literally feel like I had to do that. I felt so confused because I was becoming online to something that I wasn't aware of. And power and authority weren't a part of those things. Or should I say power and authority over people? I needed power and authority over my craft and how I chose to create. But I had chosen this path and power and authority over people. And although I had hated it so much, I had begun to see how much I hated myself, how long I had hated myself for.
What do you see when you look in the mirror today?
The first thing I see is my father. I see his eyes. If I wear facial hair, I see his mouth. I see his nose. And then I see myself. I see my hair, my forehead, the veins on the insides of my temples. I see my smile. And those things remind me of being a kid and loving those features as a kid, not knowing what they were, but loving those things. And this is what I see in the mirror now. When I hated myself, I didn't see those things. I was blindly looking into the mirror, looking purely cosmetically, not aligning myself with anything or anyone else, just mindlessly looking to wear a mask.
When was the last time you saw your father?
The last time I saw my father was before he died. In 2008, he was laying in a hospital bed. He had lost a ton of weight, and he wasn't in my life growing up. But when he was in my life, he would always speak in third person. Dad's gonna do this. Dad's gonna make sure you guys have this. So those last few moments of feeling him and seeing him, it was him speaking in third person. Dad's gonna be all right. Dad's gonna see you guys grow up. Dad's gonna see you guys successful. And Dad really likes your shirts.
Why do you think your father referred to himself in third person?
I think because he didn't know himself fully. He didn't love himself fully. And he spoke in third person speaking to himself, as well as speaking to us. I feel this, and I know this, because I do this today. I don't necessarily speak in third person, yet I evoke commentary while speaking, especially when I'm speaking to close friends. And when I'm speaking to them, I'm reminding myself as well. So when I think about my father speaking in third person to us, he's speaking to himself as well. I wish I had more time with him to know what his mind was like, what his emotions were like. And of course, I'm always curious as I meet certain parts of my emotions, of my psychological self. I talk to him through my thoughts, through my commentary. And I try to navigate if he had the same feeling.
Will you be a father one day?
As of right now, the answer is no. Before, it was an idea. However, it's not just an idea. It's a contribution to the planet, to our environment. And although I'm sure some people are going to hear this and be upset from hearing me say that I choose not to have children, it's a choice that I'm willing to make right now, because I do not feel that it is a contribution that I should be making to the world, or at least yet. I have no idea what's in store for me in my future, but as of right now, that is my choice, is to not be a father.
Are you dreaming these days?
Not like I used to. I yearn to dream. For a while, I haven't really been able to remember or conjure memories from any of my dreams. And I wish for this gift to reappear so badly, because I miss dreaming so much.
Why do you think it's not present at the moment?
I think it's not present at the moment because I haven't been present. My environment has encouraged me in some sort of way to be mindless, which in return I have escaped from feeling and seeing my dreams again, which goes back to me wanting a change in my environment so that I become more meditative and mindful so I can remember these dreams and become present within these dreams.
That was Ian Robertson. The music which accompany Ian are from his two new albums, Saturday Drone, Volume 1 and 2, which are both available now on Bandcamp. This is your host, Ayota Tereksia, and you've been listening to Asian Provocation.